But it's like health technologists that remain on the traditional matters and orders of paramount in our people. They are the custodians of this ancient and beautiful land, and so we pay our respects to all the past, present, and emerging, and we will pay for this country together by ensuring the decisions for the neighborhood in line with our principle that was the quality based our children with their intimidation on this land. Now, what we have, everyone, is we do have three apologists, you know, Councillors Chica, Pascali, and Gill, but they are going to be listening to us on Zoom, so I'm a little bit cloud. How long are they on there? Yeah, are they able to hear us this evening?
Yeah.
All right, so, Councillors, I hope you can hear me. I know you're there as members of public, so to speak, and I will remind you later on that when we do the confidential part, and we will have to leave our virtual gallery at that point. Well, I hope you enjoy it otherwise. Thank you. Leave of absence? Yeah. Okay, does anyone know that there are anyone in person that they need to make? Thank you. Councillor Mulch.
My declaration relates to item 8.1, correspondence from you see the structure for Brooklyn, which is a confidential item, but I think it's clear that it's from an applicant for a matter that she's currently in front of the CAT. So I can so make any public, even in confidence, comments on this one. So I'm probably right.
Thank you very much. I don't have any opening remarks this evening, so we go through to anyone planning in that public forum, finally, the rest. Okay, so we don't have anyone in the public forum in the minute. So the main business of our meeting this evening, at this special meeting, is the annual business of the board. Okay, so that's item 7.1 on your agenda. Now, what I'm going to do is so I'm going to ask either CEO or Mr. Lewis to go to the So, Mr. Lewis, if you just like to introduce this item, I'll be giving you a little bit of a feeling for a little bit of water. If you just have a great pleasure, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Your Worship. Just a few comments and updates that I'll give everyone to this report.
Thank you.
Firstly, the first one doesn't directly impact the report that you're considering tonight, but to let you know that there's a $1.7 million grant which we were expecting to receive. This is a federal assistance grant which is typically received on the 30th of June. This was not received, and this will be received in the following financial year. This unfortunately has the impact that it will take $1.7 million income out of last year and put it into next year. In reality, it makes almost no difference to council at all. It's just a move between accounting years. And it does mean that you will have a significant deficit in 2023-24, and unfortunately, the additional revenue just falls into the following year. So when we do the first budget review, when we have money, we'll have a more significant surplus in 2024-25. I'll just reiterate, it's a difference of a few days in reality.
So, can I ask a question? Will be, and we have the asterisk back in our little thing with the people understand that?
And it doesn't actually feature in the report at all at the moment. And typically, when we try to keep the annual business plan to relate to the activities of that to try and reduce any confusion over what.
No, I understand. So, anyone else have questions? I've got over here. Councillor Daniel, follow up.
Thank you, Matt. You said that you received this financial year.
Yeah.
Do you know when? Are they trying to hold it off like 6 months or is it a few days?
No, it's a few days. It might be in our account today.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
All right, thank you, Councillor Sheldon and Councillor Hellman.
Is there any chance that we could receive the following years in the same financial year so we end up with a double payment effect in that financial year?
Yes, that would be the assumption that there is a high probability that will happen. But it also could be that the federal government is now going to go back to reporting, paying the money in the correct year. So the $1.7 million mostly belongs to 2024-25. But this is a follow-on from a number of years ago when it was pushed World Bank. So it's almost like a correction But we just don't know what will happen at the end of the year, so it becomes a little bit unclear.
I support all of you there. I can believe there will be some notation in the accounts about the filing and receiving of the FAG grants. And it's particularly confusing when we've been confessing for 11 months and 2 weeks that we're going to have a ballot budget for last year. Now we're going to not have it. We're going to have a huge deficit. There needs to be some explanation in the accounts explaining that. And I recall that in the annual report, we were provided with a summary of the pay of grants and approved, when they were paid, I've shown over a period of 3 or 4 years that where the money, the time of the money. And I really feel for the all councils and Mr. Lewis, you just don't know when it's coming in. You know, it really makes it difficult for the board of defense. So I'll try and get some notification in the budget. And definitely in the end of the fall, we do that. That will tie the bits in there. So I think that makes it very clear that people are looking at why did this happen and make it prefer to pay in the end. Mm-hmm. I might do that.
Can I just respond to that? This will be analysed in the annual reports and in the financial statement. There's a reconciliation done which explains it.
Yeah.
The reason why I wouldn't recommend putting in the annual business plan is the numbers are consistent as they are. They don't reference the end of year results for 2023-24. So if we put a comment in, we're referencing something which is not shown in the annual business plan in the budget. And that's why I suggest we don't include it. It will be explained in detail when we do the first budget review. And that can also then connect to final figures for 2023-24. I fully understand that we want to avoid confusing anybody and to ensure that the right information is put out. But if we include in our business plan, we're referencing something which isn't actually there. But I do take your point, this probably no perfect way of doing it because it's a very imperfect result.
I disagree with the professional advice. Simply people in the street and people like me that can refer to it. I'm not going to go into detail, but it's a pity that it has to be put right in something.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a role, so I'm just going to give it straight away. But if the Chair has made a good point, and that is there's not actually reference in there. And so that does have confusion, and then it's all that stuff actually hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So I understand the way you suggest to be that report. So I hope you're okay with that.
Yeah, maybe it's some
Does anyone over here? Councillor.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. My question is about our cap and rates. I think last year it was 12.5%. Was that?
I think it's 15%.
No, your banks. And the last year?
Yeah.
I was recommending some issue. My question is how many ratepayers took advantage of the rate cap last financial year?
I'm sorry. I don't know off the top of my head.
Anyone?
I think that after my recollection, it's a small number of mutual plenty, but I can't tell you in qualitatively what it would be.
It's too late to do anything now. I think 15% is a bit high. Certainly, 15% on your rates increasing is high, but having a cap set at 15, I'd be interested in what the industry average is if there is such now.
This is the rating on the payment.
Thank you.
in the neighbourhood type zone.
Yeah.
And then the other one is land that is not located in the neighbourhood type zone.
So,
where is the neighbourhood? It's going to explain where the neighbourhood type zone is. So, that includes townships. Neighbourhood type zone has been to be used over the coded by the in reference to 0.148. My question, really the question, if it's in a neighbourhood type zone, understand that, it's in the township zone, understand that, when I read the 149, they can not located in that zone, I'm starting to assume that means rurally. Might be waiting to land there. Is that what that's needed to say? I'm not going to finish it tonight. It's like a bit of detail. I should have asked him.
Well, as a way, it's a question, is that something that you can ask Mr. Lewis to know if it means house, as council understand in more rural areas?
My understanding is that what it means, but I'm not. I don't have the definitions in London, so I'll just say that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
That's my one. I was going to do something better there, and I'd ask that 0.1.3.2, but I think Mr. Lewis could have a figure that can be inserted in there.
And so now, there's still more for me to put into the introduction to go through some of the charts. So, not for me,
I'll withdraw that.
Apologies. It might be further from that. There is a capital value to be added in, which is in the minutes that we have, but I will tell you the total proposed capital value is $17,054,765,200. So that's the figure that we, that's the latest foundation we received, and that will go into the minutes, which we do, section 1.3.2.
So do you want to read out, that's 1.3.2?
Yeah.
So, do you just want to read that out so that people can say that again?
17054765200.
So that is this. Okay. All right, does anyone have the other question? Thank you, thanks for passing.
Sorry, and I apologise for not asking before. In our words, we've got 840 non-rated properties. Can you just clarify the definition of non-rated form?
Through the chair, the definition of the option in contract rates on who would typically be made up of.
Key figures in the annual report and that are in the motion that we've got on the agenda. And I'm just wondering, is this the correct one? Is this the actual motion or has it changed again? It's not in the motion, it's in the actual report. At the final page. It's in the sustainability analysis. It's got some figures.
So did you know that question?
I'm not sure which one is there.
Yeah, sorry, this is in the sustainability implications. So there's operating surplus of 457,000, operating surplus ratio of 0.8%, renewables capital expenditure of 12,007,000. That's it, renewable ratio of 100%, given upgraded capital expenditure of 4.545 million. forecast closing balance of borrowing is June 2025, 561,000, and then financial liability ratio of 56%. That's different to what's actually in the report, the actual annual report. I don't have exactly what the difference is, but I guess I'm just interested in what those think. I'm assuming it's sort of like a moving piece, basically, that every time things change.
So through the chair, the numbers shouldn't be any different. I'm not aware of them. We did make some changes very late on in the process, but they should have been updated to agree between them and certain. In the last annual business plan, the last draft we would produce, but they should be the one attempt
the
should be the latest.
Should be Okay, I'll just double check.
I'm just trying to find my assets in the report.
I checked a couple of minutes. Remember that? Maybe I was.
If you're comparing it to an old version, then they have changed.
Maybe I was. I think. Operating surplus ratio operating surplus ratio on page 19 in the annual report says 0.76%.
Mm-hmm.
And in the actual
So generally we report it as 0.8%, but it was in one of the financial statements, we generally report it to two decimal places.
Okay.
This is flagged early in the day that there's maybe a desire for all the numbers to be consistent. The problem is it's either consistent in that part of the report or it's consistent across the whole report. So it can be either. I think the way we were going to amend that is that it's always 0.8%,
yeah.
And it's something we've decided to do just under the CEO's delegation to update those figures.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, thank you. So I'm going to put on to move something. Now, I think Councillor Ross got a new thing earlier.
Yes, Madam Mayor.
I'm not sure if you were just asking a question.
No, I'm happy to move the recommendation as printed with the inclusion of the figure that Mr. Lewis.
Thank
you, Madam Mayor. Look, I think everyone's had a good read of this and we've discussed it at length, but I just want to extend my thanks to Mr. Lewis and his team. We're putting this together. I just commend the involvement of the chamber in discussions to arrive on the figures that we've got here. And I'm glad there was a robust debate over how the budget was going to work. That's the main thing. So I commend the motion to the chamber.
All right, so I've got a little bit of a second. Do we have any dissent from anyone? Thank you. Councillor Howell, would you like to speak?
I opposed the budget in this written report. This is the first time I've found myself in the position having to do so being part of the short budget adoption. I always have supported the results of the months and months of work with the staff doing this, the analysis. Consultation with the begin. First issue that I have is the failure to meet financial stability ratio for operating surpluses between 1% and 5%. The current projection is 0.8. It should not have been too difficult to identify some adjustments for income and spending to the mean gap of about 200,000. I am comfortable to a degree by noting that the underlying operating surplus of the state is 1.7%, against my comments about having that underlying surplus ratio bigger than these times. The second issue is that the graph should be construed as misleading. The business plan capital initiatives, page 17, item B 4053, automated external defibrillator rate, for which 90,000 has been supplied. Members were advised by the director in response to my direct question about the timing of this project. Program has been extended to December 2025, so there was no hurry to start the project. But more importantly, the director stated it was not clear which buildings were required to have these devices fitted, i.e., were they counterpointing and operating buildings, such as these premises? Or did it include buildings on council owned the plane, but constructed by a relevant staff, such as buildings at the Woodside Recreation? In view of these uncertainties, it is highly improbable that the $90,000 will be spent in the next 9 months at 11%. In addition, as I understand, there are grants available of up to $1,000 for non-profit community cultural and sporting organisations to assist with the cost of purchase of these sub-87 criteria. Applications for the first round have closed earlier in March, but further rounds are considered. I consider the debt crisis to have the allocation, $45,000, and spread the program over 2 years, so that the CEO can establish exactly what responsibility comes with the president, what buildings have to be upgraded, and undertake a promotion program with the clubs that own buildings on council wing to see if they are eligible for a grant. I will not be supporting the budget in that respect, although we don't have my thanks for the staff for putting this together. It must have been a very difficult thing to do. I think generally over the previous call or so, but it's been an easier task to come to groups with. This one has been particularly bad because of isolated one off the top, so I acknowledge the work that they've done. They've been called. I could not support the 90,000 in the vote. I did not move an amendment to have it changed, but I have my comments.
All right, thank you. Let me give, first of all, the CEO an opportunity to join on the comment. So, in the words, to the member,
People have generally got the first page, but the occasion report is the rear of the document, very important document, and there are ticks and smaller places on all of those. So, Big Brother looking over our folder should be at the time of the debate before we've gone. Well, that's
thank you. All right, thank you. Thank you for that. So, we've got a member and a second. We've got one saying, Councillor Parker, you want to debate some part of it?
No, it's, I just wanted to add a comment. I will be supporting it. I do have some reservations. I've got some reservations around whether we have enough income to be able to do the things that I think we're going to need to do in the next year or so. But in general, I'd like to add support to Councillor Herman's comment about what a gun action is, that this was under very different circumstances. We've had a lot of change in the council. We've had huge rate rises. We've had rises in, not huge rate rises, I mean huge interest rate rises. We've had rises in, you know, costs, particularly around things like construction. It's incredibly difficult. And so, yeah, I would like to congratulate staff on creating it. I will be supporting it, not without reservation, but I will.
Right, thank you, Councillor.
I think now we'll be supporting the budget, and like many others around the table, we're very thankful and appreciative of the effort that the staff have put in, and in particular, the way that we've been involved throughout the process, I think it's been really valuable for us. Now, we have a whole range of challenges, and I don't have the same reservations as some of the others have been addressing this budget, but I feel like we've gone through the process really well. We've identified where we can save money, and we've identified where we need to spend money for our community. deliver the services that we say we will deliver. There are challenges. There are a lot of isolated one-off costs which are needing to be incorporated into this budget, which ultimately does mean that we fall under that 1%. However, we do need to be mindful that the underlying budget service is well above that. I do note Councillor Hammond's comments about the defibrillator and his hesitation is due to, I guess, it being not clear exactly how that would be rolled out. But on the flip side, and at the same time, I feel it's really important that if we're in a situation where we can roll that out efficiently in the way that is appropriate and necessary for us to do as an organisation, then the money should be there to do that. And if it's not, then that can be addressed in the future as part of the budget review. You know, we have a variety of budget measures which are in the budget that won't necessarily be spent. Council member training, we have money there every year for us to undergo different trainings of professional development. Sometimes some of it gets used, sometimes it doesn't. But I think it's really important to be there. For something like the defibrillators, if it comes to a point where we understand exactly where we need to place them, we have the money there and we can do it very quickly, and it's an important initiative that, you know, it exists to save lives. I will touch on what we talked about a few weeks ago around the, the changes we made based on the consultation. It was great to get so much feedback from the community about what they wanted and what was important. And whilst ultimately we didn't endorse all of those initiatives to be included, where there were those three key themes, I'm really pleased that we have included the Urela play space, of which we had a variety of people contact us in a whole host of different ways, including coming on to our council meetings. So overall, I think it's a balanced budget. It is a budget for the current situation which we are in, and I endorse it. Thank you.
Well, I'm just curious about that. It's my name, I'll answer the training.
So, all of those in favour of this item, please. All right, so that item is carried. And I just want to say, I think Councillor Fogg has made a good point. Do we have enough money to not carry on with them? I just think that later on, you know, when we consider the things from strategic planning, that just need to be part of the voters. And what it is, we can spend that money. So I go up to the point. All right, thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Lewis, and all of your team. Thanks to Nino and everyone else who's been committed to this. We've got this one on the issues, and I think that we've done. We'll move on to our next slide, and thank you. So now what we're going to do with the next slide, which is the National General Assembly item. In the past, the Local Dog Association of South Australia used to use something called a traffic light system, where they actually made comments about whether or not these proposals of the NGA were did actually match or mismatch. Yeah, the initiatives the councils in South Australia have done. I haven't done that this year, and I don't think they did it last year either, but I did check today and definitely have done it. So I'm really grateful that staff have gone through this and come up with some suggestions as well. Now, we've got six items on here, so let me work. What we're going to do is we're going to take each one of the points, 1 to 6, as a separate motion, okay? So that we can then, it's an easy way of doing it. Don't want to do it in bulk in case someone approves the policy or another. So we're going to move it that way. So I'm looking, first of all, Ms. Gill, do you want to introduce anything about this? I might be having questions on it, and then any way you want to move. Okay, so Councillor Parker, have you got a question?
Yeah, just that question. I don't remember us doing this before, so we've sent delegates.
No.
So could you just do a bit of background around why we're doing it now?
Yeah, that's correct. We threw it in there. We haven't done it before. We thought this would be a helpful process to undertake, so that just to kind of ensure that the motions that were voted for or supported by the representative of the council. So as I say, normally the policy was applied, and it will send out to the council that we're going to use that, possibly use your own council and whatever priorities. Okay, then, so if we let's break this down. So the first one,
This, the opinions that we express here and in the report by endorsement of the report, they're not necessarily bond at the that you are.
Yes, they should
be. Yeah, okay,
So, just somebody else have a conversation? All right, so the first one is to receive a note, and I'll get it over. Thank you, Councillor Seven, Councillor Daniel. We'll take that as the moving and secondly. Are you saying you want to talk to this letter? Thank you. Anybody wanting to say something to the note? So let's just go and let's take the vote on this one. Please all those in favour. No one can vote unanimously. Now, what we've got this move board number two is to actually endorse those voting recommendations that have been outlined in appendix two of the report. Bear in mind what Councillor March has just said, and the response you just got is that we would consider those as a divided. All right, so I'm looking for someone to move that. Then I'll look over the left hand side. And this time, so this will be able to move the green water. Thank you, Councillor Clarkin. Are you wanting to talk? Do you have a seconder? No, looking for a seconder, please. Thank you, Councillor March. You want to say anything, Councillor March? Right, thank you. Anyone wanting to debate? What you say? Okay. All right, so all I'm going to do is go straight to the line of things and ask all those in favour. Thank you, that's carried unanimously. Okay, so now we're going to move into, if you like, the more substance of the items. And part three of this is we're looking to vote in support or against the proposed motion 25, Murray River Council, New South Wales. Happy to give an example when we move to the meeting. Okay. So we're going to need to, are we able to bring up? I just want to make sure that everyone's saying that. So, Councillor Zell, would you like to move or take the question?
I would like to move number three to vote against proposed motion 25.
It's not a people here at Hacksmith.
So at the moment, the National Gallery Assembly calls on the Australian government to implement remuneration requirements for councillors to be evened across all states and across all council categories, both councils, metropolitan, regional, rural, etc., and the that they set that be set at a level that enables elected councillors to devote a substantial amount of time, at least half FTE, to undertake council matters.
Oh, so thank you very much for that, Ms. Hill. So, you want to propose a vote against that? Would you like to talk to them? So you can go
second. Yeah, I'll be quite brief. I actually don't think it's appropriate for all council categories across the entire country to have the same remuneration. I think Queensland, for example, is a situation where they have a very different system of council, and it sort of is a stand-in for a representative model of state government. And I don't think of that. And that's just what we do here in South Australia. I also think it's a state issue, not a local issue. So I don't think we should be supporting this. I do think that there's an argument to be made, which will come up in local government reform later in this year, about regional and rural councils getting the same as metropolitan councils. And I do think there's some positives around that. But I think to standardise it across the entire country is taken away from the nuance of
All right, but remember, safety one will speak. Councillor, I've got a question.
And again, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to, I just want to double check. So, are individual councils remunerated separately so that they can pay us, or does that come out of the budgets of individual councils? So, do you get money from the state or federal government so you can pay our stipends, or does that just come out of the private budget? Obviously, if I read the current budget in great detail, I've been able to answer my question. And I have read it. I didn't think so. So, yeah, I therefore agree that it would be difficult to make that call, because different councils obviously have different levels of income, depending on their rates of revenue and their outcomes of having these. So I agree to impose that one standard across all of them. Therefore, you know, it's going to be a greater competition on some councils than others. So, yeah.
Thank you. I'll go to Councillor Martin and Councillor Daniel.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Look, I agree with this particular position. I was reflecting that if I was paid a half FTE salary, I probably wouldn't actually run an account to be able to run the council, because I need to work full time, and there would be an expectation that half my time I would be spent doing council duties, and I just don't have half my time to commit to that. So, and also the other thing I think as well is that different states have different local government acts, and they have different divisions of responsibility between state and local government and federal government as well. And so therefore there are different sort of roles. And I think as Councillor Silver said, in the eastern states, I think in New South Wales and Queensland, possibly Victoria as well, councils have a lot more responsibility. And so therefore it would make sense for them to be paid more. Whereas in South Australia, some of the things that councils do in the eastern states, the state government does here, so we don't have as much responsibility. So I think we need to have some flexibility across the country in that area. Across the state, I think we should be looking at with respect to what councils get paid, but that's another matter.
All right, thank you, Councillor Dunning.
I was going to reference the employee stuff, but I won't. I'll just defend that. Murray River Council, we put this forward out of 11,456 in their council, whereas somewhere like the City of Melbourne has 177,000, and then Brisbane has 1.3 million. Mm-hmm. So the idea that somehow we should all be remunerated in the same way, I think it's short sighted. And everyone else has said other things
at all.
So,
well, thank you. Anything else for the council? Thank you. All right, I'm going to go back to Councillor
Sowell. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify something that Councillor Parkman said. So, our remuneration is actually set by the remuneration program, so we actually don't get a say over how that impacts our rates.
It still comes out of our rates.
It does, but we don't get a choice about that. But I think the points that have been made by the councils around the equity amongst councils and things like that makes it clear that this is something we don't need to be doing.
All right, thank you. So I'll put that to the vote. And those with other votes. Well, let me turn to Karen. Thank you. We're going to move on to point four, which has become motion four, which is standing 2-4. And we're all looking for here because whether or not we're going to support or not support the proposed motion 26 by new council of city council. So that's only very important to hear this one. Okay.
You know, this motion is around the superannuation for elected members. It's all part. Part A, note that there remains inconsistency across Australian jurisdictions where our councillors, mayors, and board members are not automatically entitled to the superannuation guarantee contribution, allowing the unfortunate politicisation of this important part. B acknowledges that those most adversely affected by the non-payment of superannuation payments for work performed as an elected representative is women. C, note that superannuation should be a universal monetary system to support all workers and taxpayers in Australia. And D, rationalise the superannuation system for local government elected representatives and amend section 12.9A of Superannuation Guarantee Administration Act 1993 to mandate that all councillors across Australia automatically receive superannuation guarantee contribution as part of their allowance.
Well, thank you, Mr. George, for explaining that. So, does anyone have a period of time?
Yeah, it's actually four. I think it's about the process. So we voted against that previous motion number three. So that would be reflected in the change in the motion. So currently in our agenda, it says to vote in support or against. The minutes would be reflected in the motion we're voting on would be to vote against.
Right.
Okay, question. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
One question, Mother. In terms of taxation, we received the land, we don't receive wage. And receiving land and write off expenses to go to that land. There might be some indicators from the income tax assessment back that can get paid a dean that our allowance of salary and tax chip renovation and a guarantee might take some other benefits away. So I don't know enough of this report.
I can't answer that. Has anyone moved to the Lewis? Any other idea from the tax agent?
Income tax. Income
tax. Yeah, I don't know what their main is, so we don't know what they are.
I want to give an answer to it. It can vary from the person's individual circumstances, and I can't pay tax advice.
Thank you, Councillor Parker, and I'll come over this side.
Yeah, sorry, I realise I got to the question, and then potentially I would like to make a comment. So my understanding, and you can confirm this, is that the way we're paying is a stipend, is that correct? And I checked this with my accountant recently. If you say a person is paying a stipend, often provides an extra opportunity to earn skills and, you know, gain experience. So it's supposed to cover your expenses, and it's not necessarily taxable. So
it is taxable.
It is taxable. No, yeah, like they get taxed along the way. No, my account says that it's a stipend, and stipends are not taxable. Is that not true?
We all have the name of your
account.
I just like to stay away from tax.
Yeah, thank you. So I even looked it up on the government website. So maybe
I've got it right. And thank you for the time we moved over here today. Thanks a lot.
I would like to move this just to get the ball rolling as a support, just so we can have a bit of debate on this one. I believe that superannuation should apply to all forms of income of this sort of nature. It's taxable income. If my son, for example, gets a job at the local deli 3-5 hours a week or 6 hours a week or something like that, they get paid superannuation and that contributes to their retirement income. And there are perhaps not so much on this council, but other councils and interstate councillors who are, and probably mayors in the state, who their council allowance is their main form of income. They should be building up for their retirement. And this is the more universal that we make superannuation, the more it is that that it becomes something which allows us to rely less on the welfare system, on pensions and things like that once people retire. So I believe this is a natural step in the step to make superannuation a better system, basically.
Well, once then we look at the draft support. So, Councillor Brown, what's your view? Are you seconding?
Yes, my view is I agree with Lee.
Thank you. Do you want to say more?
No.
Right, thank you. I'm going to move on to second aid or the same thing with the item. Anyone want me to further debate it? All right, I'll have that. I don't think Councillor Lodge, you've got me to
say
that. So, I'm going to go to the vote, please. All those in favour. Thank you, Lunch Pad. All right, let's move on to sorry. So that's unanimously in support. Okay, so we go on to point five, which is our motion 725. This is whether or not we wish to vote in support or against motion 124, also by Newcastle City Council. And I'll read that. We're not
there. Really, Matt, this motion is about voice parliament. It's the National General Assembly calls on the Australian government to continue to demonstrate strong leadership and support of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples by legislating for Indigenous voice to parliament to provide advice on issues relating specifically to Indigenous peoples.
All right, so that's the motion. How do you feel about this? I've got two people here. Just ask please back to me for
that. I was
going to say that's on the vote. All right, that's too fair. Because you're
the
question? No. Okay, so Councillor Hammond, you'd like to move on.
I'm
going to
move and in support of that. I'm very conscious about local government getting involved too much in federal politics. That's better than fortunately. The other thing, this says legislation, it's not the laws, but it says legislation, so maybe they're going to introduce an act rather than amend the constitution. And just looking at the results in Mayo, if we are here to represent our constituents, that's the base I talk, what do the constituents want in Mayo? And 59% did not support the change of the constitution. Overall, South Australia represents 3%. So if we represent the voice of our people, we support this current motion. And the other thing, I don't know whether it's driven from, by white fellas, or has it been a push from Aboriginal groups? And I make that comment because in the voice of the South Australian Parliament, there was another one from our Aboriginal Reconciliation Working Group nominated, right, and there was no president in AHC or Mount Baker that nominated on this work. So there does not seem to be a push from our residents to do this. That is the reason that I believe caused the nomination.
All right, so we've got a conversation on the table here, but against this item. Let's see if we go second up first. We have a second up. Thank you, Councillor Huxton. Would you like to call?
I can't say anything about what Councillor Hammond said. I agree with his opinions and views.
Right, so we have a moving a second. We have some dissent anywhere. Same more events. Thank you. I've got Councillor March.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can understand where the people are coming from who want to oppose this because we did have a referendum on this particular issue. I did actually want to correct something that the Councillor Hearn said. We do actually have a member of the Reconciliation Working Group that did run for the voice, Courtney Hunter Everman, who is one of the traditional owners, paramount owners in this area. And has recently joined the Reconciliation Working Group as part of our policy of having an open seat for traditional owners. She did run for your local voice. She wasn't elected, but she did run. So that's just important to note that. I personally, and look, I can understand why people have issues with this. However, I think regardless of all the politics, it is a good thing to do, and it's a principled thing to do, to have a voice to Parliament representing the voice of Aboriginal people. And my personal opinion, particularly in hindsight, is that this is what should have been done in the first place. With respect to whether this is a place of local government to vote on things like that, there's all sorts of notions in that list of motions, which are all lots of federal and state issues. We certainly have a position to advocate on behalf of our communities for all sorts of different issues. We can express opinions on those. It's obviously not binding on the federal government or anything, but I actually think it's something we should be doing as a matter of principle. The interesting thing, actually, when I reflect on what the people in my local ward, in the Rangers ward, I haven't done the numbers totally for the entirety of the Rangers ward, but there were a large pocket of very positive results down my end of the council district. Certainly, the booth which I worked on at Longwood, I think we had about a 65% in favour vote in Bylaw, Stirling, Ballgate, Bridgewater were all very strongly in favour. I could argue these are people that voted for me, and I'm representing their interests to vote for us. So, which way do you go with that sort of argument, basically? I don't know how this is going to go with the rest of my elected members, but I commend you to vote in favour. Against
him. I've now got Councillor Austin talking, and I'll come to the Councillor.
Question, Madam Mayor, under the rules of the National General Assembly of voting, are a delegate, so are delegates allowed to abstain?
Technically, no. I want to press the button.
If that's the system of voting, they forgot. They can't abstain.
They do hear. I'm not sure it's answers. No, I'm sure to the college.
My advice is compulsory.
Yeah, through the state one, you actually see the name of every council that they go to. I couldn't remember if they did that. I don't know, but my advice to my.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Mayor. I won't support this motion. It's true that probably a number of people the majority of people in this council area didn't support the referendum, but there's a subtle difference, and that was because that was a referendum to change the constitution. And this is just asking the federal government to do what they obviously set out to do, and put the nation through a referendum about pertaining to an Aboriginal voice to Parliament. They can legislate to do that, and they always could have. If they truly believe in it, they should have simply legislated, as Councillor Mudge said, in the beginning, just to say legislate the form and then disband at six, the federal government has authority to do that and should just have the gumption to do so. It doesn't need a constitutional right to do so. Wanting to do that, there's obvious reasons to do it, but they can just legislate to do what they obviously undertook to do in the first place. And I just think that it's rather disingenuous that the federal government has dropped the whole issue because they didn't succeed in getting a constitutional change, which was never needed in order to legislate. So I'd just like to see them set up their own principles and finish the job off. So I won't support Councillor Hammond's motion to oppose the vote.
Thank you, Madam Mayor.
All right, so we're fairly even on this at the moment. Anybody else wanting to speak for the motion? We have the two against, two for. Anybody else wanting to speak for the motion? Anybody else wanting to speak against? Well, first of all, I'm going back to Councillor Herman. Let me get your eye reply.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice President. I'm just getting generated in discussion. Just in response to Councillor Musk, I did inquire of staff about representation in the South Australian Board. The advice was that none of the elected central region members are members of our reconciliation working group. Or resident in the Adelaide council area on the Parkhead's cookout. Sorry.
That's not what you said. You said I all ran for.
Oh,
that's what I'm sorry.
Yeah, cool. That's what I meant.
All right, so that's a great idea.
I'm not going to start a yes or no.
Yeah. All right, thank you. So we're going to put this to the vote, please. All those in favour of the motion, which is to vote against the proposed motion, not in for. We'll move past the City Council and move back to us. And so you, if you put your hands up, you are voting against. All right, vote one. We'll have two. So all those who now are against this motion. We're essentially asking you to agree with Council over on our So that's 74. I'm going to declare the motion carried. Thank you very much.
Can I move to sign with a support?
Yes. You can, because we have nothing on the table, so you would like to move the support one. Okay, so let's open and talk to that, or...
I thought Councillor Grant had a very good point, the position of a referendum, which people voted against, was for a constitutional change, is about legislature, which is a different pattern. So that's a good point.
What I'm looking for now then is so we now have a mover in Councillor Marshall. So do you have a second? Thank you. Councillor Boyd, I'd like a second. Would you like to talk to you?
I don't mean to.
Are you sure? Yeah. We have a mover and a second. Anybody else? Can I just ask if you do want to speak, if you add something new to the debate?
Goes up and gets up to the federal government and they say, it has logic. Don't get a shot. They come back and say, you can get some money.
Thanks for enlightening. All right, so we've got a move and a seconder. And what about you? Do you need any way to reply? Is anyone else? No, I don't see anyone else. All right, so will you please vote on the item? If you'd like, please. Do you vote in support of Councillor Murphy's motion? Do you vote in support of the motion? We're still there. If you can say whether or not you would like to support Councillor Murphy's view, essentially that having been supported. Thank you. So that is, and those against? Thank you. So I've got 2-7. So I'll declare that motion carried in support of motion 24. Thank you. We have one last one, which is point 6. And I'll get the order in this one.
Through you, Mayor, this motion is around psychosocial safety, legislative and safety for elected members. The motion is. This National General Assembly calls on the Australian Government in establishing proactive steps to identify the core elements required to create a strategic, collaborative, and consistent national approach and potentially policy changes in providing equal rights for elected representatives in relation to psychosocial safety legislation and workplace safety.
Thanks. So that's quite a mouthful. I'm just going to let everyone read that one. So that's
none of it's you. 1 by 8.
It's all that. If you've got a page, I'll have a chat on the other one.
So it's an option to give us a 2 sentence summary.
Hasn't changed since 1997, and I'll get there. It's still a motion to get to it.
I'm not going to tell you more about that, too, as well.
But back in 1997, I was a teacher then.
Well, I thought I read it. If you wanted to read the more background to this motion, it's on page 341 of the electronic version.
Yeah.
It's in the attachment. There's a human document. It's in the other version. But it makes sense. So, phase 1 and 2. Well, just does anyone want any further explanation? Have you read this background? Mm-hmm. I'll read it out the first, just the three short paragraphs, so that you understand what the national objective behind SLIDE is. For the introduction of psychosocial social legislation and workplace, it has been highlighted through the delivery of compulsory training for board staff in local government that councillors are not recognised as employees and therefore are not privy to the same protection through mandatory training under legislation. This motion is looking to explore opportunities and options to provide support and protection for all councillors. To investigate where councillors fit and have a protection of the same legislation and rights in the workplace in the context of workplace health and safety. I'm not going to go into that background there. I'm just going to Councillor Selwood. Would you like to question or would you like to move to?
I'd like to move to vote in support of Resolution 158, Ms. Councillor.
Thank you. Would you like to speak?
Yes. I think this is a really clunky motion, and I'm not going to shy away from that. I also think that this is something that is better done at the state level. However, I do recognise the intention of the motion, and I think that all of us in this chamber have at various times talked about psychosocial safety in different ways. We haven't always used those words, but it is something that we've talked about. And I do think that there does need to be some clarity around the responsibility of council as a body in managing the safety from a work organisation point of view of the elected members. So I recommend that we support this motion, even though it's not worded in the vague way.
All right, so you've moved it. We're looking for our support. Thank you. That's the board.
Yeah, I think that councillors all around Australia, suffer hard times, and it doesn't make sense to me not having any council members available to have the support that they may need. So it's a no brainer coming in from strongly support this item.
Well, that's kind of it. So we have 2 for the motion. Councillor Munch, you'd like to speak?
Yeah, look, I'm in favour of it as well. I will make one point. We do have a unified workplace health and safety system across Australia, even though we have individual pieces of legislation in each jurisdiction. So to me, it makes sense to have a unified approach to the workplace health and safety, the psychosocial safety of elected members across the nation as well. It's becoming an increasing issue with some of the behaviour of both elected members, but also members of the public, abuse, all sorts of issues. And I think we should definitely pull the focus on that. So I'll support the motion.
Thank you. Councillor Parkin, did you have a hand up? Yeah, very much like Councillor Selwood, I genuinely support it. But an employee relationship is a very different relationship than the one we have as elected members. And although employees are provided with a lot of sort of structure and support around this kind of stuff, it comes with a sort of a binding two-party agreement, which is one that we don't have. So the employees, it's expected to deliver in response for, you know, for money and protection, I guess, in that sense. We don't necessarily have the same kinds of agreements. So I agree with the principle and I'll support it, but I think that the actual, the rollout would be more complex than people might think. But I support the motion. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Did anyone want to dissent? Anyone want to add something that hasn't been said? Well, if not, would you like to add anything on? All right, thank you. So that's voted as 5-1. All those in favour? Thank you, everyone. That's carried unanimously. Thank you. So now, councillors, we come to the presidential item on our report. So I'm going to have to ask those I can now say goodbye to our virtual gallery. All right, so we're going to move in conflicts. Is that what you're going to talk
about? Well, I was going to declare my conflict, yeah. Just once again, this matter relates to correspondence received from an applicant for and related to the matter before CAP. As a member of CAP, I cannot comment or discuss matters related to your honour before CAP, so I'll leave the chamber.
Thank you. Mr. Papers? Just to remind councillors that we have a shortish workshop, maybe you have a 5-10 minute break and then you bring the message.
Right, so the meeting I have in quarter day, and you've got a small calendar.
Thank you. We'll get started.
David, you can go first.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll just start with acknowledging the country. Council acknowledges that we meet on the traditional lands and those who want to thank our people. Yeah, we pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging as the custodians of this ancient, beautiful land, together with the affairs of this country for the generations to come. We've got a couple of relatively short items tonight, but the first one is pretty short. An update on the Orgat Means sheet, and then we'll hand over to David to provide that update. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Greg. Just proof that there was a really through the presentation, right?
Yeah.
So it's a fair bit to that, but don't worry about it. You will recall that there was a deputation given to council, or it might have been a public forum presentation, I can't remember. And then there was a motion moved and council resolved that staff go away, work with the shed, the Orgat Men's Shed people, to help them find another home. You'll recall that there was a risk or a threat that perhaps their current site at the Orgat Village World Church site was going to be potentially subdivided and parts of it sold off, and so they needed to find another home. So the resolution is to go away, try and help them find another home. We've been doing that, and we have analysed quite a few options for them, some that are good options, some that aren't so good. I will just remind everyone, of course, that council already owns and operates a community shed at Uraidla, and we sponsor and support a community shed at the Hutt Community Centre run at Orgat. And these participants are very welcome to join either of those two programs, but they do want their own facility, so we've been helping them to find that. We have just received an update late last week, though, that says the proposal associated with Yorgate Village Royal Church is now off the table. And so the urgency around this is not there. They're not looking for a home immediately. They have indicated to us, though, that their preference would be to find a better place and would still like to work with us on those options. But really, for the sake of time tonight, I just wanted to let you know that that urgency is not there anymore, which is good for them and good for us too. But we will continue to work with them in the longer term.
I know that you're saying there's no urgency, but I'd still be curious, out of everything you've explored, what are you looking at having further conversations with them about? Like, with any particular location? I was CC'd into that honour that you received with the update, and that has, you mentioned, they're still looking for that further exploration and finding another home. Is there anything particular of note?
So these are the sites that council owns that we've looked at. They've also been working with some community-owned sites, so we've given them a list of sites and contact details for community-owned sites, which would be great if they went to one of those. With our sites, a couple of these are tied up with, dare I say, trust issues, which basically stop us from entering. They want an exclusive lease over a site. So a couple of these sites are tied up in trust issues, which do tend to cause issues for us. Mylaw Parklands is a site they looked at, but as Tonya and Renee will remind me, there's a heritage agreement over the site that used to have a tennis court on it, that they were pretty, it could have been a really good option, but that's not usable. And one of the sites, Atkinson Reserves, being actively explored. CFS have a lease over part of that site that they're looking at, but I guess we understand there are some discussions happening there between the parties which may make that feasible. So there are a couple of feasible options. This Nation Ridge Road one, which is actually owned by the Hut, we just listed it here as a specific site that we're going to explore during the workshop. That's owned by the Hut. The Hut has that on the market at the moment. They're trying to sell that site. So that's not, well, assuming the Hut continue with that process, that's probably not an option, unless a really generous donor comes along.
Sorry, just one other, I guess, site. I went to that Lake Hill, the Regional Waste Management Authority, yeah. And they have a shed on site.
Murray Bridge.
Yeah, so they've got a shed on site, and they utilise a lot of the stuff that's been recycled. It's really quite good.
Yeah.
Was there any consideration given to the Heathfield resource?
Not that I've been told, no. So the Public Services team has been following this up, and I don't believe it's actually the Heathfield. Thank you.
Is the
I'll ask though, and I'll come back to you on that.
Is the plan that if they do find a space land that they put their own shed up? There's all those big places haven't got a shed, like the Nation Ridge Road is the one.
Yep. So they're looking for land at the moment. Any further requests for, and can you also fund a shed?
I thought they might be looking for somewhere with a shed.
Oh, yeah, ideally if you had an empty shed, but who's got an empty shed? They want 200 square metres, which is nearly double the size of this room here, probably 1.5, nearly double the size of this room. So they just aren't empty sheds like that.
So they'll obviously fund that for it.
Or someone will fund it.
But I'll make a decision through the Membership Australia, baby.
There are grant programs. Yeah.
All right. So, someone will continue the dialogue.
Yep, absolutely.
With the group.
Yep. And we'll come back to you.
Options as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we can come back to you and run through all the detail or anything else. We'll follow up with the Heathfield option. And when this gets a bit more momentum again, we'll come back to you at that point in time.
Any other questions?
We can both buy the OTR land.
It probably has got pre-existing use rights. Noisy, the neighbours will have noisy saws and things going on there. All right, so with that, Tonya and Renee, who are no strangers to you. We were in this very room a few months ago, you will recall, had a workshop on issues around native vegetation and particularly encroachment issues. And destruction to native vegetation that's unauthorised. What can council do about it? You'll recall that we kind of got about two-thirds of the way through that, and there was some interest in continuing that workshop discussion. So Renee and Tonya are back to do just that. So this is hopefully to get, you know, to enable a little bit more engagement and, you know, make sure that everyone's questions are answered and a bit of input into this process before we, I guess, formalise the, what we're doing from a policy perspective. So I'll hand over to whoever's going first.
Us.
Here's your clicker.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if anyone's online. See you online.
Hi everyone. So we have this title for this policy just keeps moving around, but in the end, through our own internal processes, we landed on native vegetation protection and conservation policy, but that is open for discussion. We wanted something that covers off on native edge protection, but also lands managed for conservation value, which doesn't always have native edge on it. So just wanted to run you kind of like how I wanted to do the presentation, but you can stop me at any point to ask questions. Just a bit of a recap on why we're doing this policy, because it's been over a year in development and there have been some changes and we've adapted that a little bit to meet with some of those changes going on. The second part I wanted to just touch on briefly is if, you know, so I don't know if anyone got a chance to do the pre-reading that went out. There was a draft version of the policy that got circulated up on the elected members portal. So the sections 1 to 5 of the policy are really kind of like the scope and the context and the definitions and the guiding principles. And then section 6 is really the policy statement, like how we have through our internal staff workshops, we've worked across various teams to sort of talk about how we would embed that policy in our procedures. However, that level of detail is not in the policy, so I just wanted to elaborate a little on those in the presentation, because it's probably a bit hard for you to wrap your head around what I mean by the, you know, the things we've stated in the policy. And then some, you know, inviting your feedback on that section as well, because you might have some ideas about, as people who are living in the community or have dealings with council, there might be opportunities there that you see that we can deliver some of the education programs that we're talking about, or and then we have a couple of questions for you, which we really need your input on before we can finalise the policy, and then you know just open to any questions from you guys. But obviously you can stop and ask me to elaborate on anything as we go through. So just a bit of a recap that we had. This policy was really, it had a different title in the beginning. It was called the Bushland Encroachment Policy, but it was an action that was raised back in the 2012 strategy. We didn't get around to it because it was a medium priority action and we have a habit of writing very ambitious strategies and we don't get to everything in there, but we carried it forward into the next one because there's still a lot of interest in the 2019 strategy and bringing that forward. So the intent of it was really to try and address some gaps. So we have a lot of language in some of our existing policy that and legislation that says we may or we can do a certain thing, not we shall or we will. So the idea of the policy is to like commit ourselves to responding in a certain way. We wanted to develop something that gave us some consistency in the decision making and council response as well. And there's a bit of a gap between the PDI Act and then the LG Act and Native Edge Act. So when a planning, a development application goes in, the planners can approve according to, you know, the PDI Act for that development. But there's a bit of a gap there. We have a separate process for accessing our reserves and our road reserves. And sometimes approving the development can mean like the person assumes that they can just cut down some native edge at the side to access their development, which is not always the case. They at least have to get permission from us and we need to sort of provide some input on that. There are things like there are allowable clearances under the Native Edge Act, but that doesn't mean we have to clear those max allowable clearances. If we have something like a policy, it has a point at which we said, well, we're not going to remove the native edge unless we really have to. So, you know, you can move up to 5 metres alongside a fence line. You can clear native edge. Doesn't mean that as a council we can give permission or decide to do that. We can make, you know,
our own policy about how much we agree to do and how we assess that.
Just on that point.
Yeah.
Made a bed because I had 5 minutes down the fence. Are you telling me that you're saying, well, I think you don't need funding?
Depending on the circumstances, yes. So,
for instance,
yeah.
It's, if the private property owner says, yes. The native edge act says there can be 5 metre and it's right, yeah. They can do that on their property. To do it on our side of fence,
yeah.
It's our vegetation. So that so we don't have to let them do it. It's you still got the owner has discretion. So, yeah. And this happens often with development, people build a house and then they go, I want to clear for 20 metres around the house or 10 metres. Native edge act says, I can. If any of that 10 metres is on our land, it's up to us to give them permission or not. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was the motion on notice that came through on the 11th of the 4th about strengthening our position for a regulatory response for unauthorised clearances. So in response to that, we kind of, I suppose, adapted our impact assessment tool that we're proposing that we bring into effect to sort of help bolster our position, strengthen our position against, you know, how we respond to unauthorised clearances. So did anyone actually have a chance to pre-read through and did you have any feedback on the sort of sections 1 to 5 or do you need me to call vote? Yeah?
I have a general question. In the policy, it talks a lot about protection and restoration of native veg. And I'm just wondering about increasing native veg and whether that's purposefully left out or whether that's implicit or, yeah. What
you're... We weren't seeking to address that in the policy. That's probably something we address more through the strategy. Increasing and, we're talking about remediating native veg that have been impacted and that we should be restoring that where we can, but expanding areas of restoration, I suppose, that and habitat, that's something we're kind of addressing more through our programs and through our strategy. And I suppose there's no reason it couldn't be addressed in the policy. It's just a bit more of a... I'm open to it, but I wouldn't have thought that's necessarily a policy position. It's probably something we'd just more address with strategy because you would have specific actions to demonstrate and monitor how you're going to do that. There could be a line put in here about that we will continue to explore opportunities for that. I guess, you know, it's in the strategy anyway, so there's no reason we couldn't add it to this. So, yeah.
Yeah. Just to expand a bit, so there's been a lot of discussion in this that we've had in the chamber and workshops so far about, you know, do we want to explore those sorts of things in the way of getting our land, for example, or when we make other decisions that perhaps this policy statement around, you know, we're just trying to require to increase our native vegetation in the council area, perhaps would be something to
look at including in the policy. Yeah.
Yeah. So exactly, but I think that if we're doing a bit of work in that space out.
Yeah. I guess it is an ambition.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's related to it reminding me your first priority is protect what you've already got and restore degraded native veg before you start looking to expand that. We're certainly having that conversation just this morning. If there's opportunities to expand it, if you get funding from somewhere, you wouldn't want it back. So,
and then generally, the information has been spoken 30 by 30, you know, 30% of it's been 30. So, but we'll bring that back and some kind of to council or whether it's embedded in this policy. But that's a good point.
So, yeah, that's a good follow up question. Would it help the administration in making other decisions that aren't necessarily this exact decision, if there was a policy statement then from us as council saying that we're
committed to that?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So here we have going in.
Are you going to give us time and a week or so to get back to on this?
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be,
no.
Especially if you haven't had a chance to read through it.
I'll ask a quick question. Is
local government mean land on a ditch road between the private owner's fence and the block notice to the pavement?
Okay.
Land between the private owner's fence and the ditch road pavement. Is that it?
All roads are vested in council. Yeah. The Commissioner of Highways, and the goodness of their heart, takes over accountability for certain parts of it, which is basically very wrong.
Yeah, very, very briefly, just carrying on from Melanie. I did want to bring to your attention the fact that there is some crown land that they're looking at handing back to crown. So if there was an opportunity to expand our biodiversity in those regions, that might be a really good project in that. Put that in the policy.
Well, it's always comes down, restoration is so much more expensive than just bush care and looking after the. Like, we have more remnant, high-quality remnant vegetation than anything else, and the principles of bush care are that you always don't step off maintaining that at the expense of restoration projects, because that's so valuable. That can't be reconstructed. The remnant stuff has all the soil composition and all the mycorrhizal fungi, all the things that are really virtually plants you can't propagate. We can do, we do small pockets of rebate, but without getting some, applying for some huge pockets of money. It's $1,500 to $8,000 per hectare to rebate in order to establish native veg, depending on its, watering requirements and its fencing. It's just super expensive to do. So it's not that we're not interested at all. We often turn up to various, groups to sort of discuss potential for collaborating in a large grant to get re-veg in the ground, but we don't really have the resources to do that unless we were to collaborate and win a grant. But we have recently become part of the Mount Lofty Bird Recovery Alliance, and they are investigating. It's not a good time because those 30 by 30 targets are coming in, but they are investigating suitable land for large-scale re-veg projects. And it's an alliance of universities and ornithologists and landscapes board. And so, look, we're talking with them, but we don't have the kind of level of re-veg that they're interested in doing too. We don't have many parcels of that size either. Most of ours are quite small. And so probably our re-veg tends to be more focused on infilling some of the long bare patches that we can see are not really going to regenerate over time without a bit of help. And
what's that organization that's going for life run?
The Mount Lofty Rangers Bird Recovery Alliance. Yeah, relatively new.
Thank you, Kelly. Now, thank you, then, Chris.
Can everybody get your hands on this SEB, Earth Environmental thing? I just noticed in the Annie Gillett, we just talked about 25 degrees, cutting down 7 millimetre trees or something. You've given them down to 25 degrees. I don't know what the number will be if the Mount Lofty Gold Club development goes ahead. Megabucks.
We've experimented with that. We do actually have a couple of SEB sites. So you have to go through fairly resource intensive process of registering your site. And then also, if you have a plan to put a heritage agreement on it, you have to lodge it as an SEB site before you put a heritage agreement on it. And then you have to provide a report. So we've got a couple of sites, but what we've found is there's not many people coming forward and paying that money, because you need to, for an SEB offset, they'll pay off into the like vegetation community. So we might be paying $25,000 for the Amy Gillett bikeway, but if we don't have a representative vegetation community of high enough value to qualify as an SEB site, then we can't access that. So
spend it somewhere else. Thank you, Malcolm. Chris?
Thanks, Greg. So the segue to that, I think Malcolm's point is good, and that is you might find somewhere where that money would be, e.g., a parcel of ground land that could be restored and replacing a like for like. But anyway, that's an aside. But on resourcing, and I mean your response to Kiralee's question that you don't have resources, in a way it's a fair one, but also that should be our problem, not yours. So my question really is, look, when are we going to get serious about this and have asset management plan? Like, so you've talked about environmental assets, but that's as far as it goes. If you're an engineer and you're managing these assets, you'd have an asset management plan, and you'd have a spreadsheet showing the depreciation on that asset in terms of maintenance required, so a certain level of maintenance required for different types of native, different native veg areas and the threats that they're facing. Until we have something like that, you're going around capping now trying to get money to maintain an Adelaide Hills Council asset. Now, do you see the fundamental problem with that? It's an asset like every other, and it should be resourced like any other. Is that something you can, that can't be done overnight, but a document like this might address the obvious anomaly that environmental assets are treated as an option, or you've got to go scurrying around to find funds. Well, we don't do that for anywhere, in the council.
Yeah.
Can is that something you can explore in this document, or...
Tony actually has done some work on that in the past and crunched some numbers based on our bushwrap figures. It's a bit of a moving feast because it really depends on how weedy the site is. Like you're talking about, how much does it actually cost to get that to pristine or high quality value and then keep it there?
Wouldn't be easy.
No. So we have done some preliminary work on that. Tony put together some spreadsheets. We did kind of have a look at... I had some figures for this, so
what we might do is, I guess, is this policy the best place to cover that? That's more the vision. So what can we take that notice? Because it's a really important one. It's an important point around how we treat, because I'm with you, I agree.
Yeah.
These are green assets and they have been evaluated. Let's ignore the accountants, how they treat green assets. It's really about, long term, if we're going to meet that 2030 target, we need to treat it seriously. So can I take that on notice with the team? Is that okay? And then see whether it fits in this policy or is it a different policy altogether around the strategy around biodiversity, native vegetation.
Yeah.
And if this only referred to the development of such an asset management plan or similar, that's a toehold anyway. Sorry, you were about to say.
Oh, I was just going to say that it's a good idea. I guess like this policy was really kind of set up with the more of the how we're going to, just mainly stop people doing illegal things on our land. It's about how we're going to manage that and prevent it before it happens and how we're going to respond to it when it does happen. So I guess that was the scope of this particular policy. But we definitely have in the past tried to sort of put some how much would it cost, and it was basically too much too much to really do more than, but bushcare principles are that you do a little bit at a time. But there's no reason we can't sort of pick those data sets up again.
But we can't just say it's too hard. We've got to stop saying that. Yeah. We said that about every environment issue we're faced, and look where it's got us. So forget the too hard thing. Just come out with the scary numbers.
Okay.
We'll
go pick that spreadsheet up and bring it back out.
You've got to change it.
You've declared a climate emergency,
and
we need to do the work.
Yeah, that's why you've got an elected chamber to say, don't self-regulate, just tell us the truth.
All right.
I'll
bring you all back to get
you've already mentioned this, but we do have earmarked in this next 12 months to develop a biodiversity strategy.
Yes. So,
biodiversity strategy. So a lot of these aspirations, I imagine, will
come into that.
Exactly. And, you know, the usual way that we call biodiversity strategy, there's going to be council, like the council member workshop as part of the series of workshops that we run for that. So that's the perfect place to kind of start bringing those ideas and then we talk about them and we workshop them and then we framework them and then, and then we make a draft that meets all of, you know, everybody's aspirations for biodiversity management. So I didn't really want to get into this today in the workshop, which is kind of the context and the setting up and the background, but you're welcome to come back to me with, you know, anything you have on the, any feedback you have on the first five sections of the policy, because I feel like it's really late and to go through all that in detail now is going to take us to ridiculous a plot. But one of the things that we talk about in section six is really kind of like some higher level statements about how we intend to implement the policy, which from a staff perspective, like we understand how that is probably how we envisage that to be done. And we've kind of workshopped that with our staff, but it's not obvious in the policy or maybe to elected members about what we mean by some of the statements. So the 6.1.1 community education, the kinds of things that we're talking about is, you know, helping to communicate and educate resident rights and responsibilities regarding LG land and roads, activities that require permission from council. A lot of people have an assumption that if it's a road reserve, they're allowed to cut it down, cut the veg down and drive a car on there, including, you know, developers and stuff have that assumption. And just because it's a road reserve, it doesn't mean that we have to allow them to cut remnant veg down on it. So there are points at which we could sort of communicate that probably a bit better to maybe, you know, developers or residents. Responsibility for accurate identification of property boundaries, due diligence at time of purchase and when applying for and undertaking development activities. Responsibilities in relation to bushfire prevention and weed management. We've kind of started work in this area. There was bushfire mitigation landscape strategy, but under that we also did a mail out of a fact sheet to every single person who lived next to a native vegetation marker system site. Does anyone know what they are? It's a roadside managed conservation purposes because it's got remnant veg in it. So they've got a fact sheet posted to their mail address to explain what the rules are about, you know, what the values are of those and what you can and can't do on an NBMS site. Purpose and value of local government lands and roads. This policy, once it gets up, and you know, our ideas are that we would communicate via the website. There's also triggers across various council processes. That might be the property team, that might be the planning team, it might be our environmental health officers. There's several points of contact that a resident would have with a member, you know, a staff member. So these are all the kind of points of contact we're kind of saying that we need a sort of work out how, you know, how we deliver, we're going to do better at delivering that to the people at those points of contact. And new resident packs, there's information we could be including in there, letters and, you know, letters to residents adjacent heritage agreements and conservation land standards we did with the NBMS. But, you know, there's probably other points, I'm sure there's other points of contact that council members might have ideas about where we can sort of deliver some of this information or education. Does anyone have any ideas?
No question.
you don't have to tell me tonight. You can get back to me on that one. And so one thing that the policy talks about is we really want to prevent clearance and encroachments before they happen. That's kind of really the goal. You know, it's not a great experience having to punish and remediate. It, you know, we'd really like to get in there before it happens. That's the preferred method. So we're looking at embedding measures that prevent the impacts in our council processes, which is like primarily through development applications, S221 permits, which is authorization to alter a road reserve, just general permits and leases. So if you're going to use any of council land, you need a permit for a lease. And we can, we're kind of, I'm going to get to a bit later on to an impact assessment tool, which will help determine conditions we set on permits and leases and information that we give to someone who's applying for one. So a couple of the things that we've been working on is, we have the S221 permit, which is for roadsides. We don't have one yet finalised for reserve access, but that's what we're saying, that we have a reserve access one that someone needs to, if they want to use our reserves for anything, they need to get a permit in writing, and that gives us a chance to intervene before something we don't want happening. To, you know, we can set conditions on that permit. And also getting our authorised 221 permits on GIS so they can be accessed via tablet in the field. So that just means that when our staff are going around doing their daily duties using their tablets and they see something that looks like it could be an unauthorised activity, someone's cutting down native edge on a road reserve, they can use their tablet to see if that person's applied for a S221 permit and whether it's been granted or not. So that if they don't, they can report it to us. They can be confident about reporting it straight away. Another one is the development assessment process. So we've been kind of working a lot with the planning team to talk about where are the points of opportunity, or when the points of opportunity to prevent something happening before it actually happens. Part of it is having the right spatial layers available to them so that they can assess outside what's happening around the actual development, proposed development site, and involving us early on in the process. How I can see, like, this development application has come through. I want someone on the bio team to review it because it looks like it's either next to some native edge or like a heritage agreement site or anything that's on the biodiversity register. And then that gives us a chance to have a bit of a think about if that development is going to, if it looks like they're going to try and access it through some of our land, we might be able to say, that's our point to say, we have to request more, give them an RFI request for more information. And then providing the applicant with information outlining their obligations in relation to local government land and roads, and that's usually through advisory notes. So the planning team can't withhold, they can only assess the development against the PDI Act, but they can put advisory notes saying this doesn't automatically give you the right to drive in through the side to the council as a form. We've got some nicer wording than that, but you can't just go on a land that this is doesn't approve that. This is for the, you know, the development within your property only, and then there's you need to apply for a permit to access our road reserve or reserve. One of the things we talk about is developing an encroachment register. So that's, I feel like that's fairly self-explanatory. We're kind of like making a list of all known and reported encroachments, and then just reporting any communication that we have with them, so we don't get the "I didn't know, no one told me that I can't do this," because there's a record of it in the encroachment register, and record the results of the impact impact assessment tool that we're proposing, and the determined actions to take to rectify and/or remediate the encroachment.
Just for a moment, how do you know where the road is? When the old property committee exists, we were saying roads everywhere, and not all roads exist. So,
when we have
to. Who's going to tell them that tree?
So that's where our tablets and the field come in really handy because it lines up the cadastral. I mean, it's fairly accurate, not 100%, but you can usually get a pretty good idea by, you know, looking around at the landmarks to make sure. But the when we're in the field with the tablet, it puts a, it's like on your phone, it has a marker where you are in that landscape. But we also have a cadastral boundary in there, so you can see if you're walking along it or not. You can kind of tell if it's out because I know I'm standing next to this tree and that's not, so you might have to wait, come back on the day where the satellites are in better view. But for the most part, it's pretty accurate. And that's why we're talking about getting some of the more of these permits up on our spatial layers, because it really helps people in the field, in the course of their duties, figure out, okay, this person's got a permit, but it doesn't go right to the end of the road. It's supposed to stop here, but they're clearing all the veg down to there. So
you don't go just by a fence line.
Sorry?
You don't go just by a fence line.
Not always. Sometimes they're wrong. But, you know, they're accurate then if we go by the fence line. So we talk about in there the operation and regulatory response, and what we're proposing is that our response at council will be guided by an impact assessment tool that we've drafted, and that where the score is high or if the voluntary compliance is not embraced by the relevant individual organisation, our response will escalate. So, you know, if it's a smelly, fairly small impact, then our, you know, we might just issue a letter of education or have a conversation. Or if it's a really high impact or they've been told no, they're not allowed to clear that native edge, but they go ahead and do it anyway, our response is a lot higher. And I'm going to hand you over to Tonya here because this is where she's going to talk you through our impact assessment tool.
Oh, I never realised what the glass was like because that's really small. Sorry.
And just, I'll just check councillors, it's almost 9:30. Happy to. How much more is the presentation?
Can we get some questions about this?
Yeah, you've waited a long time.
So I'm just going to go through this assessment tool we've drafted. We haven't workshopped this with any of the other departments, so this is the draft. It's to help guide council in our response to illegal clearance, bring about some consistency and some transparency in the way that we deal with them. So this initial section of the table shows some fairly overall categories. So you know what you see the scoring down here. So you rate it against if the piece of land has any formal conservation status. Spatial impact. So this is related to how much more the proportion of the land that's been cleared. So say if you're talking about a reserve and they've cleared 5% or 10%, then you assign the score. And then the level of alienation of public land from the public. So that's a 0 to 3 rating. And then the approval. So this is important as well. So approval might be granted, so that gets a 0, or it could be completely refused. And if the clearance is undertaken, then that scores a 10. So you can see how the total score at the end can be quite elevated if you get a scenario where someone has been refused and then they go ahead and do it anyway. And that was the case at Stock Road where we prosecuted. So the other categories are assigned for specific scenarios. So you've got the use of permits. Can't quite see it up there. So this one relates to if native vegetation community has been impacted. This is for scattered trees only, and this is for tree damaging activities. So then obviously you add up your scores, and then the response down here. We've tested against about 15 to 20 actual clearance scenarios, ranging from very minor accidental clearances to significant and deliberate clearances. And so these are the thresholds where it swaps over from a simple warning letter or an order to a fine or a make order or remediation. Or a full prosecution, and those two are highlighted because we haven't really kind of worked out if those will occur as part of a prosecution or a fine. So this is obviously still a draft. So in terms of working through these types of these two categories here, we're using a tree scoring methodology that's developed by the Native Vegetation Council, or the Bushland Assessment Score Sheet. So that helps us determine the significance and the value of those trees or that veg community. Anything to add to that?
This tool will be very affected by some of the slides we have. So we have to actually talk about a litigation budget, essentially. So this impact assessment tool is going to be guided by some of the council members' feedback about whether there's no point having a scoring sheet that takes us through to when we decide to prosecute or not, if there's not essentially a budget that's put aside for prosecutions, because a fairly easy, straightforward case will cost about $5,000 in court fees, and some of that you'll get back, but probably not all of it. A messy one, $20,000. Yes.
Just a question about the funds. Oh. I guess for me, I'd be setting the tool out of concern of the impact on biodiversity and then set our budget based on what we think we need to spend, as opposed to let's change the tool because our budget doesn't fit it. Does that make sense? So if you think this is the right tool, you think you need X dollars to implement it, and we want that applied, then we need to make funds available, as opposed to going, oh, we don't like that it's going to cost a bit of money, so let's change the tool that was actually designed to protect the environment, unwind the whole process and integrity. That's fine.
Right, that's what we want to do.
So
you've got to go.
It's
an unknown quantity.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you're
going to
face each year some of the historical ones.
You shift the lines to what's accepted.
We were thinking that as a start of that, our proposal is a budget of $20,000 a year, and that allows us to pursue one prosecution a year. Like if it's messy, if it's not a messy one and we get a few lower impact ones that aren't as messy and they're quite clear cut, we might have an opportunity to do a few more. But, you know, the Red Services team is like, I can't commence this process if I don't know where I can end, because, like, how do we start this now? It could end up in 20 grand, you know, with court fees. And I don't want to, like, start off and then back down halfway through because, you know, we don't have a budget for...
Yeah, my mother, sorry. Yeah.
No, I don't think the budget, I think that's very councillors, and I think the executive team, that budget might need to be together.
Okay.
What we're trying to do is make sure that we're protecting the
litigation.
I was going to say, the point about litigation, there'll be things from an enforcement perspective that come up throughout the year, where there might not be, but I'm totally getting the point of the discussions you've had with the regulatory team. But there'll be things that come up and we'll still make a call, even though there's no legal budget set aside to
invest. And we'll bring that back to council for the variation. So no difference any other budget. Sorry, Chris.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Greg. But just on that, having a budget, I think
encourages
the administration to say, oh yeah, let's spend our budget and do all these prosecutions. Yeah, why not that? but
if the tool.
Yeah, it satisfies the tool. Okay. Now, we've got a couple of questions about the tool. One, it doesn't seem to assess the damage, as in how bad it's damaged, whether that mown and it will come back, or whether that bulldozed. It hasn't done that. Now, the thing is, I don't know about the spatial impact. Why is it a percentage of total area? You know, 10% of 200 hectares is... It's a lot.
Yeah.
If it's a tiny area, you know, 10% is insignificant. Should it be just, say, 100 square metres, more or less, or is there a reason why for that percentage? Because that's...
Well, so initially before we brought this into it, this biodiversity assessment methodology score, we had relevancy in there. So if this clearance occurs in an environmental association that has, you know, a small amount of remnant vegetation, then the clearance is obviously more significant.
Okay, yeah.
But the BAM scores take that into consideration. They take a whole range of different parameters into consideration. So that's why we went with that, because it's already scoring that. So spatial impact, I suppose, you know, it's a proportion of, say, you know, of a reserve, you know, that I'm not sure. We're still kind of working through that one.
Yeah, and this is, I suppose you try it on some existing cases and say, is it about right, or whether that's just not giving me anything.
Yeah, it's supposed to be sort of a bit more helpful where there's not. So we have, like, all of our conservation reserves and all of our NVMS sites, we have that BAM score already. There are sites where there's native veg clearance happening where we don't have a BAM score. So we're kind of trying to guesstimate, like, how will we assess the impact of the way in situations when we don't have a BAM score. And sometimes it's very hard to even apply an SEB score because it's like we can't exactly see necessarily what's been cleared.
Well, that's the tricky thing about the tree scoring as well. If the trees are gone, it's really difficult, obviously, to get to get all those values. We'll have to work through that somehow. There are other categories that we can add in there. Some that have come from Native Edge Council, things like loss factor. So, you know, is it completely lost? Is it just degraded or, you know, just a tree damaging it? Not just a tree damaging activity. how far did it actually go? Have they completely cleared it all?
I'd also put in a fact in there, recidivism. You know, like, is this a serial offender or not? I don't know that goes into this, but where do you feed that in?
Yeah, you're probably right. That's like, actually, we have a lot of people, you know,
yeah. So that could almost come in here as well.
Yeah.
You know, you've got approval granted. It clearance exceeds the approval, no approvals or clearance undertaken despite refusal.
Yeah, that might.
Or slash repeat offender. Or
just tweak it a little bit to get those open.
Okay. And so we're talking about, like, we may develop a rehabilitation plan where we talk about the 6.4 section, we may develop a rehabilitation plan. And we may also, we actually have under our bylaw, under section 262 of the Local Government Act, we can actually, an authorised person, member of staff, can direct a person in breach of the bylaw to comply with the direction, and if they don't, we may seek to recover costs from them. So there is a kind of mechanism there that we can use to try and recover costs for if they refuse to do cease or remove their, you know, the damaging activity. So we've broadened this term of encroachment to mean also where they're dumping their green waste, where they're stockpiling materials, where they've got an old rusting out car which they've decided to park there on top of our bed. It's just like a broadened definition of encroachment, not just built structures. So that if they don't remove that, and we ask them to, that we can have that removed and then charge them the cost and any remediation to the native bench underneath. And this is what we were talking about before, that we'd set aside a management fund for helping us, with regulatory activities perhaps recovery activities as well. So not just the, litigation costs, but also some of the remediation costs. And we reserve a space for historic encroachments, because as we worked through on that last workshop, I don't know if everyone can remember, there's such a variety of situations that occur over time. It's a bit hard to apply the tool necessarily on a historic case, because there's been changes in council policies, in legislation, and sometimes we find when we go out there, they're like, oh, someone from council 15 years ago said they wanted me to mow out to 20 metres into the reserve because they didn't have the resources to do it. So I don't have maybe that probably was true, you know, but the way that we deal with things now is different. We don't, you know, that's not an appropriate way to continue forward from this point onwards. You've got changes in ownership. So some people buy the property and they, you know, they didn't cause the damage. It was the person before them. And, you know, sometimes that happens. And, you know, now we have better technology to assess who the responsible person was and what the impacts are with spatial layers, aerial photography, Google Street View. It's very hard to sort of gauge that going back through historic encroachments. So I guess the main questions we had for you were around the budget, whether you're good with the title of the policy, or if there's particularly any opportunities to incorporate some preventative measures that we haven't thought of.
On the budget, have you missed a zero
there? Yeah, that's a typo. That's Chris would want
that. No, seriously, what
are
you going to do from that?
Yeah.
Mine's just, it was what I was going to say earlier about the budget as well. I anticipate, as with most expiation type processes, initially we will require more money because people think they can get away with it at the moment, and the more the community learn that it's not acceptable, we'll get better adherence to policy. So me, I'm obviously supportive of that amount, but also that if you find that you're weighing up prosecuting and you think it's worth prosecuting, that proceed through a budget review process to enable it to happen.
Okay.
As opposed to you going, no, I don't want to pull. Because the moment you pull back, what you should be doing policy and kind of undermines it, and again, you won't get that.
Self-sabotaging.
Yeah, you won't get the adherence to it longer term.
Yeah. Right. Well,
yeah. I'm just wondering, with the opportunities to incorporate preventive measures, I know this is pretty basic, but would signs work? I mean, it's okay if you've got a nice patch that you want to protect and they're next to someone who, or you get a whisper, or can you just put a sign up saying this is protected.
Yeah, do we have a good, we have a site, do we have a site strategy? Yeah.
So our MBMS signs all have like another little extra sign underneath it that explain that you can't do these things on there. So those are all individually signed posted at the beginning and the end of the MBMS. In our conservation reserves, is this what you mean? This,
yeah.
Yeah. They're more about the entrance and exit points. And while we do have a signage strategy, it kind of is not focused on that. And quite often we have beach owners as under heritage agreement. It's a heritage agreement site. Talking about? And it has like the, you know, like the no smoking sign with a series of activities that you can and can't do on there, like no picking like native plants and no harvesting firewood and, yeah, those sorts of images. But it's a bit hard because our reserves in particular, because quite a few of them have so many entry and exit points. But we try and get the main ones with those large signs that have, like, yeah, activities you can and can't do.
That's a point. We'll take all of those.
That was really it from me. And then I guess, you know, if people didn't have a chance really to sort of read through the policy before tonight, then I can just leave it open for a couple of weeks and you get back to me with your feedback in that time frame. And then we take what we know now that we have your encouragement with the execution plan, and we take that back to staff and really kind of try and bed down how this impact assessment tool will work and make sure that we're like really working on that with the reg services team to make sure, yeah. And the, you know, the property team and the planning team, like they'll all kind of be impacted by this tool. So yeah. Any of your, yeah, yes, Chris?
Yeah, just one more thing. I guess because a lot of this is about behavioural change, have you thought about the use of the media and how you manage that? Because it's always a bit tricky. It's like how do you communicate this stuff? I know the Native Venture Council, when I was in the bump, very reluctant to do media stuff.
Yeah.
Which misses the whole point of what you're there to do.
About enforcement?
Yeah, no, of course, man. They would not do press releases. They said, oh, well, the minister might be embarrassed. It's like, well, yeah, the minister can. It's irrelevant. You do your job and it's got to be known that you've done your job. So I'd like to think that approach would be taken.
Yeah, I think we can. Probably not. Not the people doing a media release in the coming months. So that's no weird decision.
That actually understand. Any other questions? But of course, as indicated, yeah, about a week or so, open the any feedback on policy as it stands.
That's right. And then, you know, once we sort of we take that feedback, we're doing the rounds again. Yeah, and then we bring it back essentially for probably endorsement after we've incorporated all the feedback or at least got a reason for why that might not work. And this was as close as we could get to. You know, what your proposal was. That's how I imagine it going. But yeah, after that, we'll do another round with the, you know, the staff, like in the different teams, and sort of goes that, you know, is this all going to work or how do we make it work? And then, yeah, bring it back for endorsement.
Thanks,
Paul.
Thank you.
All right. No worries.
That brings that session to a close. Thank you to the councillors and staff.
Excellent.